Okay, we have arrived to my last session. You will be greatly encouraged and helped by Corey when he shares with you as well. But I do appreciate, thank you for allowing me to be here with you and to teach, to get to know you. It is it's a precious thing when the people of God come together, a local church. It's just such a precious thing. This is a foretaste of heaven when we're together, when we fellowship, when we worship. Rick asked me about what about collaboration and supporting. What about supporting a missionary or an apostle of the church functioning in the context of the Great Commission? That isn't necessarily out of this church, but that you know of, that you want to help support. How does that work? What is that? How does that overlap with what we're talking about here? Well, there's a couple things on that. There's scriptural warrant right here in what we read in terms of churches collaborating together to complete a task. Here it was the collection. We don't really know if these apostles of the church were sent out collaboratively by a group of churches, or if they were each sent out by one church. We don't really know that, though it's not critical. There's some Christian wisdom and prudence in ascertaining that situation. One is to consider, you know, let's just say that you hear of a missionary and you're interested in supporting him. He's not from this church. One of the first things you would need to know is, what church is he from? Because if he's sent out specifically by one local church, well, that's who is going to be primarily overseeing the work, and he will be accountable to that church. You need to make sure that you're in full agreement with the sort of direction and accountability that church would give. So clarity on a doctrinal and philosophical, missiological agreement, I think, would be really important. And maybe some sort of relationship as well. Now, if they're from a certain church and you don't really have much of a relationship or had much involvement with their preparation, then you can't exert much authority over them. I think supporting a missionary or an apostle of the church in the context of the Great Commission, supporting them does give you a right. It at least gives you the right to pull your money if you're not in agreement with them. And if you have a certain level of relationship, then you could have the potential of providing some direction, some oversight. But that's all going to depend on your relationship to the missionary and your relationship to that other local church. Now we're really talking about partnership, levels of partnership. So my encouragement to you would be, one, pray that the Lord would raise up missionaries from within your local church. Two, ask the Lord for discernment and wisdom in evaluating other mission opportunities, supporting missionaries who are not from this local church, where it can be a fruitful partnership. One other practical thing to consider, and this is, you know, it's not a right or wrong question, it's a matter of wisdom and what this local church desires to do. Local churches can take one of two routes. One, we want to support a lot of different works at a small amount each. We want to give $50 to 20 different works, $50 a month to 20 different works. And we want to support, that's one way to go about it. And that's totally fine. That's a wonderful way to do it. It has its benefits and its drawbacks. The other way to do it is, well, we just want to support one or two missionaries, and we want to be heavily invested in those. And there's benefits and drawbacks to that as well. But it might be helpful to go ahead and consider that as you guys are in a place of kind of reevaluating your missions involvement, to decide what direction do we want to take as a church. If you don't decide, it will be decided for you. And generally what's decided for you is a bunch of small amounts instead of focus on one or two, which, like I said, is a fine thing to do. But 2 years down the road, if you decide, you know, we'd really rather, it's hard to tell, you know, 15 missionaries, hey, we're no longer going to partner with you in this way. It's not a fun thing, and it's a very discouraging thing to those that you've been supporting. So take your time and consider those questions right up front. Rick, was that helpful in the question? Any follow-up questions on those two basic topics? Okay. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yes.
How does helping train men fit into thinking about missions? Groups like that, where they're training men all the time, so they're helping churches train men all the time. What are your thoughts on the mission, particularly focusing on training people?
I think that's a very important part of modern missions right now in the context that we live in, training men. That's what my organization, ICP, did and does. Because in the global south, which includes Latin America, sub-Saharan Africa, and also Southeast Asia, Christianity is spreading like wildfire. The numbers that are coming out of those areas are phenomenal. They're jaw-dropping. The problem is when you get on the ground and you actually see the work and you begin to evaluate what's happening in those new churches and the theology of those pastors and whatnot, it's very concerning. Because the brand of Christianity that is spreading is charismania, it's Pentecostalism, it's health and wealth, it's prosperity, it's much of it we would be slow to even call it true Christianity or the true gospel. So what you have is tons of people claiming the name of Christ and lots of churches being planted, growing up, that are in desperate need of, well, faithful leadership, really. If you have a faithful pastor in that church, that's the key. That's the key that turns the lock to leading to a healthy church, or at least something happening. Maybe the church disbanding if it needs to. So yeah, I think that's a very important. In fact, some missionaries go full-time, and that's what they do, full-time. They simply train pastors. Good question. Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. It has its unique challenges. It also has its benefits. Like, for example, Kenya, where we go a lot, I'll be there next month. It's basically a Christian country. They call themselves a Christian country. They're very friendly to us coming in. We don't have to worry about being shut down or being denied visa or anything like that because of what we're doing. They want us there. So that's a benefit of that sort of thing. But the negative is that it's hard to tell the difference between, well, it's not hard to tell. It's easy once you talk to them. But basically everyone's a Christian, kind of like the South of the United States at one time. That's changed. I don't know if you know, but the Bible Belt is not the Bible Belt anymore. But in Kenya, it is the Bible Belt. Everyone is a Christian. Everyone's been baptized multiple times. Everyone's a part of a church. Everyone's spoken in tongues. It's a lot of knocking things down. You have to do demo before you can build. So in our training sessions, the first class that we teach, it's called What is the Gospel? And that class is filled with pastors who have sometimes been pastors for decades. And we're teaching a class, What is the Gospel? The second class is the role of the pastor. Now we're teaching pastors who have been pastors for decades. And if you think that it is a nice little walk through a flower-covered field with these guys, it is not. They are angry with us because we come in there with these classes and they think it's too elementary for them. And then we begin to attack at the base. I use the word attack. I mean, we're not trying to be mean in the classroom, but we have learned that beating around the bush does no good whatsoever in those contexts. We end up with people at the end of the three-year training that never really confronted their false theology. So anyway, we direct it right up front. We have people stand up, yell at us. We have people go to the other pastors' houses at night and try to form a mutiny against us and have them all withdraw from the Didache Institute. It gets very hot in that kitchen. So their livelihood is tied to it. These guys have made a good living off of prosperity gospel, because you guys know how the prosperity gospel works, right? In that context. Do you understand how it works? Let me tell you, in case any of you want to become a prosperity preacher, here's how you do it. Here's the message. God wants to prosper you. Your job promotion, your new car, your new house, your healing from this sickness, it is just around the corner. You just have to release it with your faith. And the best way to show your faith is to make an offering at this church. Now, don't, a little faith will get you a little bit of spiritual breakthrough. A lot of faith will get you a lot of spiritual breakthrough. And of course, your faith is directly tied to the amount of offering that you give me. And then there's a 30-minute offering. No joke. I've sat in these. The offering starts at 12 o'clock, and you think, oh, good, it's almost time for lunch. My ears are bleeding from the loud music that I've been listening to. It's another thing there. The offering starts at lunch, and I tell the guys that go with me, no, settle in, guys. It's not, don't zip up your Bible. It's not over. And it'll go till 12:30, these times of offering. And everyone who was born in November, stand up. Would any of you like to give an offering? And they'll look at us even. This is, they've learned at this point. And most of our pastors now have turned from this stuff. But they'll look to us and say, now it's time for anybody who's from another country to give an offering. And there's four of us in this huge church of 200 people. And everyone will turn and look at us and say, well, you know, okay. Any other questions? Yeah, it's sad. It is sad because the prosperity gospel preys upon the impoverished is what it does. It's now there is a prosperity gospel light here in the United States. It's mixed with pop psychology. It's not preying so much on the impoverished. It's preying on the spiritually desperate. The misery of the lost in this country is what it preys upon. Don't you want to feel happy? Well, here's how you do it. I forgot what we were talking about. Does anybody have another question? I forgot where that started. Oh, the context. Yeah, I mean, that's the difficult. You have to demo before you build, and it takes some time. That's why our training is 3 years long, honestly. We stick with men for 3 years because the first 2 years, it's trying to convince them that by his stripes you are healed does not mean that God wants to heal every Christian of every sickness. It means something much greater than that. All right, let's go over these briefly I just want to re-emphasize them. Number one was the inward call from God. Verse 16, Paul writes that God had put an earnestness in the heart of Titus on behalf of the believers. So these are the characteristics and qualities that should describe an apostle of the church. They should have an inward call. An eagerness, desire, earnestness, special love, a godly jealousy. These sorts of words should describe someone who is desiring to be sent as a missionary. Now, the extraordinary earnestness that Titus possessed, it didn't originate from his flesh. It wasn't just his own, this would be neat. It was from God, and it did not originate from the church. It wasn't an obligation that the church, and I don't mean that in a bad way, the church ought to obligate Christians, push us toward obedience. But this wasn't it. It wasn't that the church was obligating him. It was bestowed upon him by God. However, this inward call does not diminish the role of the church in setting apart and sending out. An inward call is necessary, but it does not diminish the outward call and affirmation and preparation and official sending out of the church. Again, this flies in the face of the way that Western missions has been done in a lot of contexts. It's almost like when someone has a call to missions, it's like they're this otherworldly thing and they're now outside of the authority of the local church. They're now outside of any ties to the U.S. It's almost like this David Livingston, and I'm not saying he was like this, but this conception of this guy roving Africa, and praise the Lord for him. We don't have a clue what's happening with him, but hope it's good. Number two, the voluntary acceptance. This is not a problem, really. We don't have that sort of culture in the West in terms of obligating people. This would be more of an Eastern problem. But it needs to be an acceptance of the call. The church ought not compel someone against their will, ought not be manipulated against their will to accept an appeal to reach a certain country or people group. The church made the public appeal, but God put the earnestness in Titus's heart. Do you see how those two things work together? Titus longed to go, and the church longed to send him. Number three, notoriety in the gospel. Notoriety in the gospel. The great lesson here to be learned is that those sent out from the church to advance any cause of Christ, whether preaching or collecting an offering, must be mature in the doctrine and mature in their doctrine and also in their character, especially with regard to the gospel. Goodness, especially with regard. It's crazy that we have to say that, but and I'm not nothing against this church at all. I don't know this church that well, but I've seen many, many missionaries on the field who could not give a proper explanation of the gospel. Number four, tested by the church. This is where the word dokimazo is used. It's the same word that's used in 1 Timothy 3. It's probable that the apostles of the churches were attested according to this same standard as the elders and deacons, where we find that word in 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 13. Those who were sent out with the ministry of proclamation were elder qualified. And those sent out with a service administrative ministry were deacon qualified. Now this gets to a question, and we've already brought it up, like, of difference between, what's the difference between a pastor and a missionary? There's a lot of overlap. We see that here in this part of what an elder, what an apostle of the church ought to be. And I want to touch on a difference here in just a few minutes as well. And then we'll talk about Turkey. Number five, appointed by the church. There are no rogue missionaries. I was in an airport in Quito one time and ran across it was a teenage, 18, 19-year-old young man. And I noticed he had a Christian T-shirt on, so I started to talk to him. And he was going back to college. He was visiting his parents there. He grew up there as a missionary kid. His parents were still there as missionaries. I said, "Oh, that's interesting. Who are they sent by? What church are they sent by in the United States? Who supports them?" "Oh, they're not sent by anybody. They decided they weren't in agreement with their church, and now they're independent missionaries." Well, that's like the north and south pole of a magnet. Those two words don't fit together. There's no independent apostles of the church. There's no independent missionaries. It was a rebellious Christian couple. And what you'll generally find as well, as was the case in this, was that they were doing less than primary missionary work. And these aren't bad things, but generally those sorts of people are in focus almost exclusively on helps sort of ministries, orphanages, feeding programs, literacy programs, appointed by the churches. Having been tested and approved by the church as worthy of being representatives of the church, Paul tells us in verse 19 that these men were appointed. So not only were they qualified, but then the church said, "Okay, we see your qualifications, we see your affirmation by the church as at large. You have an inward call. We're going to appoint you for this mission. You desire it. We desire that you do it. We're appointing you. They were not self-appointed, a la Robert Duvall. They were not independent, but they were tested, approved, and under the authority of the elders and churches who sent them. So if a church sends out an apostle of the church or a missionary, and they find out from that missionary that, well, they're doing a lot less evangelism and not really focused on church planting now. They've noticed a problem with street kids, and they're going to start a home for street kids there in Calcutta, let's say, Kolkata. That's a wonderful thing to do, but it's not the will of the church. So what should happen? They should be warned. Brother, this is not why we sent you. The will of the church is for you to spend your time in evangelism and church planting. And if you desire to evangelize those street kids and help them in different ways, we approve of that. But your primary task is this. So a month later, you check in. How's it going? Tell me what you did. Well, more advancement on the home for street children. So he's disobeyed. He's decided to go his own way. Well, then the elders buy a plane ticket and they go over to talk to this man face to face. Brother, you are not carrying out the will. You're not faithfully representing. You are an apostle of this church and you're not faithfully representing. But the Lord is calling me to take care of these street kids. No, the Lord is calling you to submit to the leadership of your local church. No, I know that the Lord is calling me to do this. The men come back. Church, this man is under discipline. He refuses to obey. We've confronted him. We've asked him to repent. He will not. Let's take 1 month, pray for him, write him letters, send him emails, plead with him to repent. A month goes by, he doesn't. Well, then he's excommunicated. He's put out of the church. He's no longer supported by, he's no longer cared for, he's no longer under the protection and accountability of the local church. He's now a rebellious, he's treated as an infidel. That's a hard thing to do, but that's the process. Because what is his role as an apostle of the church? To carry out the will of the church, to faithfully execute the message and the will of the church. Finally, a glory to Christ, number 6. In verse 23, Paul refers to these messengers or apostles of the church as a glory to Christ. It could mean two things, that the men were a credit to Christ, or that their character and their words and actions brought praise to him. It doesn't really matter which it is, because missionaries ought to be both of those things. The difference, let me read this quote from Paul here. He says, "The difference in translation matters very little, because when those sent out by the church reflect the glory of Christ, they are also a credit to him and bring him praise." Okay, terms. Should we start calling missionaries apostles of the church and stop calling them missionaries? Should we do that? Thank you very much for that answer. Why not? You're right. Why? I'm asking too many questions now. Because what? Because why? Yeah. Yeah, because someone else. You're right. Good job, buddy. Who else has an idea? Why? I'm not saying if you do, I'm not saying you're in sin if you start change terminology. But wisdom tells us that it is better to use missionary with teaching behind it. Why? There is a widespread ignorance of what an apostle is, and especially a distinction between the apostle of Christ. And when I say ignorance, I don't mean that mean. I just mean a lack of knowledge. An apostle of Christ and an apostle of the church. In fact, I'm guessing that before this morning, you may have never considered the difference between an apostle of Christ and an apostle of the church. It's not something that has been taught on much at all. So for the time being, it's wise to use the term missionary in order to avoid this confusion that our brother just mentioned there, while at the same time giving teaching to the churches about those two terms. All right, I want to touch on briefly how the work of the missionary and the work of the pastor overlap and how they're different, and then I want to share a bit about Turkey. Before I jump to that, does anyone have a question? Yes, sir. Yeah, the platform. Yep.
Is that in a way misrepresenting what you're doing? I think it was better.
Yeah. 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 Well, and that is a different topic. And so let's just take away whether that's a moral thing to do or not. If the church, so a man who's sent out, he should not do that unless the church fully approves of it. Unless the church is aware and knows and is a part of that. Now, I'm leaving the whether it's right or wrong side out of that for now, okay? That's a different question. Whether it's pleasing in the sight of the Lord to deceive a government in order to get the gospel into a country. Should we do that or should we not? And Corey will answer that question later. All right. Thank you for doing that, brother. I appreciate that. No, but it is a question. It is an issue in missions, and it comes in a it manifests in a lot of different ways. If you've ever heard of Brother Andrew, that's a good case study. Brother Andrew, known as the Bible smuggler, would sneak Bibles into all sorts of Eastern European countries. I think China as well, deceiving the government to get the scriptures to people in those countries. That's all I'm going to say about it. So the work of the missionary, the work of the pastor, what is the difference? Is there really a difference? And let me just summarize a few things here. The work of the pastor is to care for souls, would be one fair way to put it, right? Would you guys be in agreement with that? The care of souls. You could say shepherd the flock, pay close attention to the flock, but to care for souls. Could we say that same thing about a missionary? I see a lot of yeses. Is it? What, I mean, what about, you know, let's take William Carey, who goes into India and there's no Christians there. So, well, listen. Yeah, good. Yeah, exactly. We think of care for souls generally in terms of a Christian being helped to grow in the knowledge and the grace of the Lord, which it is, and that's what pastors do primarily. But is it not also caring for a soul to tell them of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Now, what they do with that you know, that's God's business. What effect that has on their hearts, whether a work of grace is wrought in their heart, well, that's beyond us. But is proclaiming the gospel among a population, among a city, among a village, among a family, to one person, is that not, in fact, loving that person? Is that not us seeking to care for that soul? So I think in some way we could say that the work of a missionary and the work of a pastor both is caring for souls. But let's consider soteriology for a moment. Let's consider the Ordo Salutis, the order of salvation. And we'll have a little pop quiz here. Let's see where our theologians are. What would you say is the first step or stage in the order of salvation? What's the first act or the first work of God that takes place in our salvation? Yes, sir. Okay. I'd say that's number two. Election. Yeah, election. Good. Election. Yeah, and we, of course, we weren't there. Have nothing to do with that. Election was all God's work from before the foundation of the world. After that, we'd have calling, have regeneration, conversion, justification, adoption. What comes after adoption? But what'd you say? Okay, so calling, regeneration, conversion, justification, adoption, those all happen right there together. It's a package deal. And it's even strange to put them in order like that because it's not necessarily, but it's all right there. It happens in a moment in time. But after that moment in time, that's, you know, we're not taken up to heaven immediately, are we? That's when the process of what? What's the next one? Sanctification. And finally, at the end of sanctification, the very last one, what is it? Glorification. So the Ordo Salutis, that is God's work of salvation for his people. That's what he does, right? God does all of that, correct? But after election and before glorification, we have this list of things that God does in real time through means. So let's think about the work of a pastor. Pastors are helping people get to heaven, right? Pastors are helping people get to heaven. What part of that Ordo Salutis are pastors primarily involved in? Sanctification, right? They're very involved in believers' lives through counseling and preaching the word and praying and meeting one-on-one, raising up leadership and discipline, those sorts of things, the sanctification part. What is their primary tools for doing that? Prayer and ministry of the word. Prayer and ministry of the word. That's it. Now, it's by the power of the Holy Spirit, and they might have other helps as well, but prayer and ministry of the word. Now, let's shift to a missionary. A missionary is working in the same world with the same God, wanting to see really the same thing. He wants to get people to heaven, doesn't he? But a missionary is working really primarily, not always, but generally when we think of missionaries, they're working in a different section of that Ordo Salutis, aren't they? What part are they participating in? What part are they being used by God to bring about his work of salvation in? What section? Yeah, really that for between election and sanctification, the call, regeneration, conversion, justification, adoption, all the package deal, when that happens right there. Missionaries are more focused on that. Not always. Obviously, there's different sorts of missionaries working in Christian context, but when we think of missionaries, we often think of evangelism, right? So missionaries are Now, what's the tools of the missionary for completing that work, for doing that work? Prayer and ministry of the word. Isn't that amazing? It's the same work. It is spiritual work. And when we do spiritual work, if we're going to do it faithfully, and if we want it to be pleasing to the Lord, and we want to see lasting fruit, then we'll do it. By the methods that the Lord has given us, and that's prayer and the word. Now, it looks different, doesn't it? When Corey was in India and someone laboring here in Felton, like, it looks different. There's a lot more curry in that part of the world. The clothes are different. The language is different. It's hotter. The house, it looks really different, but at the end of the day, at the most basic level, it is the same work. Obeying the same God, cooperating, we might say, with God in his great work of salvation in those he has elected from the foundation of the world. And whenever you look at it that way, you can see why there's so much overlap between, well, the role of the pastor, what a pastor is, and what a missionary is. All right, let me pause there. Does anyone have a question or a thought about that? Does that make sense? Clear. Yes.
Are there any other differences
Yeah. So that's a really good question. And a missionary is not just an evangelist. Let me say it like that. A missionary is laboring toward the establishment of the planting of a church in whatever area that they are working in. So that's the interesting thing about a missionary. It's kind of like going back in time, actually. Let's say that this church sends out Alex to Turkey, which he was looking at. Let's say he's going as on a church planting team and to an area where there's no church whatsoever. Well, his goal and his desire, the church's will, is for over time for that work to move from an evangelistic, primarily evangelistic sort of work and discipleship sort of work to a ecclesiological focus in terms of planting a new church there. It's kind of like this. Let's say I have a sawmill here in Delaware, and you all are employed in my sawmill. It's the only sawmill in all of Delaware. We're settling the country and building houses and lots of business. We all work hard. And one day I call Alex in and I say, Alex, they need a sawmill in Maryland desperately. I'm going to send you to manage the sawmill over there. You've been with me for years. You've worked in all parts of this business. You know it inside and out. There's no one I trust more than you in this sawmill. So you are qualified. You've shown faithfulness. You're going to go to Maryland and manage the sawmill there. And he says, great. Thank you for this opportunity. But there's one catch, Alex. There's no sawmill there yet. You've got to start from ground zero. You've got to find property. You've got to figure out where you're going to source the wood. You've got to hire workers. You've got to train them. You've got to order the parts to the saw. You've got to put it together. It's going to take you a while. Now, you've been functioning in this healthy sawmill for a while, but I'm going to send you over to Maryland, and you're going to have to start from scratch. So it's a little bit like a missionary going back in time. He's been functioning in this context, and he sees what the end goal should be. He's lived it. He's served in it. But when he goes a lot of times to a new place where there's no church, he's got to step back and start from ground zero. So a missionary, unlike an evangelist, has that whole task ahead of him. Now, again, there are other sorts of missionary work, and sometimes a missionary will go where there's already church. They're supporting a church in a different way. So that's a little bit different. But you can think of it like this. A pastor does a lot of A and a little of B. A missionary, especially when he goes into a new area, does a lot of B and a little of A. Does that make sense? And over time, the missionary, he does a lot of B and a little A, but that'll start to even out. As people come to Christ, he'll start to do more of A as well. And as a church is planted, it might even totally flip-flop. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Good question. Yeah, that's a good question. That takes some discernment, I think, on the elder's part, especially to discern exactly what's going on in that man's heart. And it's tricky because if he's running away from a call because of maybe it's fear or whatever it might be, then you want to help him be obedient to the Lord and understand what's happening and overcome that fear by the truth of the scripture. On the other hand, you don't want to box somebody in and obligate them to go when there's really no inward call there. You're going to waste time, you're going to waste resources, and it won't keep him on the field. It might for a while, but if a man is not convinced that he's supposed to serve the Lord in a context like the foreign mission field, there's a lot of reasons to come home. A lot of reasons to come home. Just read John Payton's any of these missionary biographies. So I think discernment, prayer, a lot of talking, not rushing it, keeping the conversation open until you feel like you have a good feel for what's going on. Yes, sir. Yeah, you've got to be able to tell the difference between someone who's not called and also just a healthy fear. If someone has no fear or trepidation about being a missionary, that's a red flag to me. There should be a healthy fear there, but they certainly could still be called with that. Let me share just for the last 10 minutes about a work that we are laboring towards, praying for in my local church. I'm a part of Grace Bible Church of Conway, Arkansas. We've been members there about a year now, a little over a year. And we have six elders, two deacons. We hold to the 1689 as our confession of faith. We have been asking the Lord to raise up missionaries from among us to help us to be faithful in the Great Commission. There are now two families in our church, two young families that have stepped forward and say, we desire to be sent. You desire to send someone. We desire to be sent. So now has begun the process of evaluation and examination. Now, this is the first. Well, they have sent someone else out. It's a little different situation, but this is really kind of a first time for the church. So we're learning as we go, and these two families are a little bit like guinea pigs that we're trying out. But let me just share a little bit about the process that we're going through and the work that we hope to see them doing. When they first expressed an interest, they were friends, and they had discussed it among themselves. So I met with them multiple times to discuss it. Then we sat down with the elders. The elders meet regularly, so we sat before them, and they had a chance to ask preliminary questions of these two men. Their families were not with them, but they were simply seeking to discern, well, understand what the Lord might be doing in their lives. So they asked them about things about their seriousness, their preparation, what they were willing to do, what their desires were, why they felt like they would be qualified, where they felt like this desire was coming from, so that those sorts of questions. During that meeting, I asked the elders to consider something, two things. One was, if they believed that these young men were truly called and that they were inclined to begin to send them, to look at them as though they were elder candidates. To put them through the same process that they would put any elder through. We went over some of these things from the scriptures, and I encouraged them to consider, and they were already on board with this, but my job is to help keep it in front of them, to consider the fact that they would be seeking, not only be a representative of our church, but seeking to reproduce our church in that culture wherever it is. So if they were seeking to not only evangelize, but to plant a church and reproduce a church, then why wouldn't they be? Why would we want anything less than elder qualified? That's just a matter of wisdom. They agreed 100%. So the other thing that I asked them to consider was, we're looking at a 2024 send out date time period, early 2024. January was the general idea. So I asked them to consider this. Would they look at the church budget and make it possible for these two men for 2023 to receive full support from the church, so that they would be freed up from their secular work and they could spend that full year, one, fundraising, two, language learning, three, other various preparations that they could do in order to be as prepared as possible to go in 2024. And the idea would be that the church would support them 100% or close to 100% in 2023, and all of the funds that they raised during 2023 could be banked, basically. And by Lord willing, by 2024, they would have a good amount of funds for startup. It takes, you know, it's going to take $30,000-$40,000 to get a family set up in a new country. So to have a good amount banked, and also to have a monthly amount coming in that could sustain them at that point. And so at 2024, Grace Bible Church would reduce their support significantly to a manageable, sustainable level, because these other like-minded churches would be coming in to help support them in general. The fact is, our church can't sustain supporting them full-time indefinitely. We can't do that. We wish we could, but we can't. So we need partner churches or individuals to be a part of that. And this is not a fundraising thing at all. I'm not going to pass the plate. There's not a 30-minute offering coming up here. I'm just telling you what we're doing. So the elders now are looking, and we have a deacon who's over finances as well. They're putting together some proposals what they can do. If they can't do the full support for 2023, I'm looking at my organization, ICP, possibly taking up some of that slack as well. I just believe that it's very important for them to have that year of focused preparation, primarily for the fundraising and the language learning. If you've ever been in a fundraising context, if you've ever had to do that, it's hard. It takes time. It's difficult. You need to meet with people. You need to travel. It takes time. The other thing is, missionaries who start ministry before they've got a good handle on the language have a lot harder time learning it after the fact, because they get thrown into ministry, they're busy, they already have a lot of responsibilities, and it's harder for them to slow down and take the hours, put in the hours that are necessary in order to truly learn a language, to be able to, you know, to preach, to talk deeply, not just, you know, order in a restaurant, but to be able to be fluent to that level. So that's the general plan. I'm not exactly sure how that's going to pan out. We'll find out in the next few weeks, actually. But if it works for them to go from their secular work to be full time, then we'll begin to implement a program, or program sounds bad, but basically a plan in 2023 for their preparation. I'll be the one overseeing that. They're already in seminary. They're taking seminary courses, so that's a part of it. Intensive hours a day language will be a part of it. Me helping them to fundraise in a faithful, biblical, humble, spirit-filled way, which is a whole nother topic, difficult one. That'll be a part of that as well. As well as cultural sort of helps. So we have some, well, you might be aware of the Tigrine family. Do y'all know the Tigrine family by chance? Anyway, Joel Tigrine, Emily Tigrine, they were missionaries in Turkey. Joel passed away last year of cancer. Emily now lives a few hours from us. We're good friends with her, and our church is closely connected to her. So she's a good connection for Turkey sort of stuff in the United States. She has several Turkish friends. We'll be bringing those in for several days to teach these families, you know, whatever it is that they can teach them. Turkish traditions, Turkish manners, the way Muslims view Christians coming from the United States, that sort of thing. The other big question that we're having to deal with is one that was mentioned earlier. Turkey is not, they're not overly hostile to Christians, but they're also not welcoming by any means. They don't want the Christian message spread in that country. It is a Muslim country. There are also parts of Turkey that are certainly more Western, but in general, it is a Muslim country. They don't want Christianity spread. There are many missionaries that go into Turkey with platforms. They go in with, you know, a snowboarding instructor or something like that. A lot of outdoorsy stuff, because there's a lot of tourism that comes in for outdoors sort of thing. So that is a question we're going to have to confront. Also, Turkey is now kicking missionaries out. Like, as we speak, they're rescinding visas because of the refugees coming from Ukraine. I don't know what their motivation is exactly, but they're taking visas away from American missionaries and giving them to Ukraine refugees for some reason. So something else we're having to think through. Of course, that will probably all change. Another issue, just as a side note, something to consider, because this is the world we live in now, some countries require vaccination of COVID. And that's something that churches have to work through in terms of, well, you know, some people have very strong convictions against getting the vaccine. Others say, well, I don't mind, I'll do that in order to travel there. It's something to consider. It's a question that we're having to consider a bit with these folks as well. Do you have any questions about that process, or about what we're doing with Turkey? Yes, sir. With our church, or yeah, so we support a man and his family. His name's Taylor Walls. They're in Santo Domingo, Ecuador. His role is a bit different. He is a this is one of those gray areas. Just 2 weeks ago, he was confirmed as an elder in the local church. So is he a missionary or a pastor? Well, yes, I guess we could say. We still count him and consider him a missionary. We did send him out. But in reality, technically, he's not under our authority. He is now accountable to that local church, the other elders there and the congregation. But our church supports him heavily. So there is a sense of accountability there in terms of, you know, we support him. So that's the other one. We don't have any other ongoing partnership. Well, Oh, I see. Yeah. There is one connection that we're considering. It's a family with the last name Taylor. I think David Taylor is his first one. Now, that's a long story, and this is, again, something that you guys will probably in the future have to confront. But basically what happened is this family came over to Turkey with a group of about 30 other families, with essentially what was a cult, a Christian cult, I guess you could say. But they went over there and they were going to form a utopia in Turkey. And it was just as weird as the cult. And in fact, what ended up happening is this guy was exposed for basically being very, to the most possible degree, inappropriate with the wives of the other people in the cult. And so it broke up. It went berserk, and this family was in that cult. They stayed. They have obviously changed and even reformed to a good degree. But there's still some shaky stuff in there. All that to say that Joel Tigreen, the Tigreens worked with them to a certain degree and are very good friends with them. So we have been in communication with them. We're still trying to assess whether that would be a good fit. Because it's not just evangelism, it's already a church. And that's a higher level of partnership. You need to make sure that you are in almost complete agreement if you're going to partner on the level of church planting and functioning together as a church. What the men desire to do, though, Rick, is they want to go to a place where there's nothing. That's what they desire to do. The elders are less sure about that. They are young families. They have literally newborn. One of the women's pregnant. She's due in April. So she'll have a, you know, less than year-old baby. The other woman, she had a baby, was it last week? So this is a very young family. The elders are concerned about the well-being of the wives and putting them in a situation to where they wouldn't have ready support around them. So we'll see. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes. Sure. It should not. Yes, it should not. You can't. Well, and I was going to bring that also. Let's say you had a group of five churches that are all in agreement, all the same. You know, let's say they're all in this. They hold the same confession. They're good friends. They relate to each other really well, and they're all going to go in and support one missionary who's out of one church in particular. it will not work to have five chiefs there. It's not going to work. Because the missionary is going to feel a strain between who to communicate with, between who to ask for help when there's a certain need. He's going to be trying to please all five of them and probably not feel good about any one of them. So if there's that level of camaraderie among churches, there needs to be one representative, and it probably needs to be the man, or one of the elders or group of elders out of the church from which he was sent, for obvious reasons. But there's still a certain aspect of accountability from those other churches, and that's exercised mostly by whether they give their money or not. I mean, if they disagree with what's happening, then they say, well, we're just going to withdraw support. We can't discipline you, or we can't call you to account on any official level because you're not a part of our church, but we can stop sending money. Now, in that case, they could see something. Let's say that he posts something on Facebook and one of the other churches sees it. Well, he should go to the main church and say, hey, did you guys see this? What do you make of this? He shouldn't send an email to the missionary and say, hey, what are you doing here? Well, I don't think this is what we agreed upon. It's going to create this tangled web of uncertainty about hierarchy and accountability. So, yeah. Okay, it's time, unless there's a burning question that someone else would like to ask. Thank you all. It's been a pleasure to be with you. I'm thankful for your local church. Elders, you men, I'm thankful for you. I've gotten to speak with each of you a little bit. Thank you for your faithfulness. This is the missionary sending agency. It's you. Thank you for what you do.